so bad.
Hey there, and welcome to Marvel by the Month, the podcast that takes you through the history of Marvel Comics one month at a time. In this episode, that month is April of 1967. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Rob, we've got some great comics to talk about this month once again. The Fantastic Four are going to encounter the Kree Sentry for the first time and let us know that there is such a thing as the Kree in the universe.
Yeah.
Which also, you know, starts to establish that the Marvel Universe is literally a universe and not just, you know, a few hundred square miles of New York.
Besides, like, you know, the Negative Zone, we've got a few other pieces that have popped up so far.
Right, yeah. And some, you know, random, you know, Larry Lieber created planets just drifting out in the cosmos somewhere. Mm-hmm. We've also got the beginning of the three-part Spider-Man No More storyline that kicks off with Amazing Spidey number 50, which has one of the most famous covers, I think, in Marvel history, which is very cool. And then we've also got the conclusion of the two-part storyline featuring the return of the Juggernaut.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not so sure I'd put that last one in the same category as the first two. It's,
yeah,
those are pretty epic establishment of the Marvel universe. This is, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there have definitely been some good X-Men stories, you know, since we've started this podcast, but I think right now we are definitely, I would say we're in a little bit of a rut with the X-Men. Mm-hmm. It's certainly not the comic that I'm looking forward to reading most every week when we have to get our stack together.
Yeah. It's so weird. You know, I don't understand how it can be so bad. Cause it gets so good. And I mean, I have an X-Men pinball machine. I go and I play it and I hear lines that are in some of these books we've been reading. And I'm like, man, they really pulled them out of some duds. But yeah, X-Men gets so good. It was really my favorite book for years when I was first reading comics.
I kind of wish like we had someone who could explain to us why the X-Men got off to a little bit of a rocky start. I know who we can have explain the X-Men to us. Our guest this week is one half of the outstanding Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men podcast. Miles Stokes, thank you so much for joining us this week on Marvel by the Month.
Yeah, Brian, Rob, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about some X-Men stuff I normally don't get to talk about and with some people I normally don't get to talk to on a really stellar show. I'm psyched to be here.
Oh, nice. Thank you so much. So I can't imagine that there's anyone out there who listens to this show and has not heard of yours, but just in case for that one listener who... You know, this is the first time they've heard a podcast. Can you give us a sense of what Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men is all about?
So my podcasting partner, Jay Edidin, and I are both big X-Men fans. And so one of the things that has become clearest to us over the years is that the X-Men continuity and mythos, that's really, really, really complicated. Like, superhero comics are complicated in general, but X-Men does seem to feature an unprecedented quantity of clones and time travel and retcons and science that is not science and characters that are other characters. Okay, I realize Kang the Conqueror is worse than any of this, but because we love X-Men so much, we wanted to do something to make it more accessible. We wanted to explain it. And that is, of course, explain spelled without an E, because if you're talking about X-Men, you're legally obligated to make as many X wordplay bits as you can.
Yes. It's a brilliant show. I do have to confess that whenever I listen to an episode of it, though, I start getting the cold sweats imagining what we are going to have to navigate about 200 episodes from now. So if we could have like a very quick, you know, Days of Future Past aside here, what advice do you have for us once the complexity of Marvel continuity really starts ramping up?
I think part of it is you just have to sort of go with it. It's going to be overwhelming. It's going to be self-contradictory. And that's the delight of it. That's the fun. It is utter chaos that you can get lost in like a kid in the crimson candy store of the cosmos. It's the nonsense is part of the appeal.
That helps talk me down a little bit.
You guys have got this.
And also, so I have not listened to the entire back catalog, but how deep have you gone on some of these early Silver Age X-Men stories?
So we actually have barely covered the Silver Age in X-Men. For a long time, neither Jay or I were really big fans of the Silver Age in general and Silver Age X-Men in particular. For us, X-Men kind of became X-Men with Giant Size X-Men number one in the mid-70s when we met Storm and Colossus and Nightcrawler, and Wolverine stopped just being a Hulk villain and showed up in X-Men essentially right before Chris Claremont took over. At the same time, I've been going through a lot of back catalog stuff in Marvel Unlimited. So I read through Silver Age X-Men at some point during maybe this year, maybe last, what is time? And I've actually come to really enjoy it. But in terms of our show, yeah, we covered the Silver Age in like three episodes, one of which was just sort of alternate tellings and retellings of it. And then we just moved straight on to the Bronze Age.
Yep. Yeah, I can understand.
Yeah, as we trudge through the Silver Age, that makes perfect sense.
So generally speaking, since you, even though you haven't covered him on the podcast, you are familiar with the Silver Age X-Men. What are some of your general thoughts about this era of the book?
It's hard to divide it up into eras for me, just because you essentially have, you know, Stan Lee, and then you have Roy Thomas on and off for so long. And so I guess there are sort of different eras of Roy Thomas. Overall, I like Roy Thomas's run a great deal. I like what he does as far as developing the characters that Lee created. Like, he actually has some dynamism, like, not to spoil too much of what we'll be talking about, but Scott and Jean actually talk about their feelings for the first time literally ever in this Juggernaut arc. And so I appreciate that he does that. I appreciate that we see kind of boarding school hijinks mixed with superhero silliness. It's not at the same caliber as a lot of the other Silver Age stuff at the time, but there's a lot of fun to be found. And once Thomas gets his sea legs and sort of, you know, around the time he and Arnold Drake are each doing some issues, there's some really good stuff there. Although, honestly, that might just also be the Neil Adams art being just mind-blowing.
Yeah, I am... Not that I have anything against Werner Roth, but I'm definitely counting down the months until we get some Neil Adams in the Marvel Universe. That's going to be it's going to make our jobs a lot more fun.
Yeah, I feel like Werner Roth started strong, but I think he's getting a little rushed now, too. We talk about that a lot, like his time pressures are making not helping the art sing as often as it should.
Yeah.
Or did even in some of his early issues.
I think he's also kind of running into the same stuff that Don Heck is running into on Avengers right now with Roy Thomas writing, where Roy's, you know, he's really green. He's really inexperienced as a writer. He's doing that young writer thing of trying to cram too much stuff into a single story, as opposed to, like, you know, a Fantastic Four storyline, which when we talk about the issue that came out this month versus the X-Men issue that came out this month, like, the Fantastic Four story, you can describe in three sentences. Like, it's a real straightforward. Right. And then Kirby just goes nuts with, you know, these quarter page panels and is having a blast. Doesn't happen that way on X-Men.
No, there's seven plot threads that you jump between constantly. And you can see the artists, like, trying to struggle to stage a scene, you know, let alone get through some action and show how that happens with the limited time they have before jumping back to plot thread D.
It may just be that I have Chris Claremont Stockholm syndrome, but for me, like, that level of, wow, there sure are a lot of things going on right now, just kind of is X-Men to me. Like, well, of course there are. It's X-Men. It's complicated. Even in the Silver Age. I recognize that doesn't necessarily work as well with every creator as every other creator, but I kind of felt right at home with that part.
That's true.
There you go. Yeah. Excellent. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad you're along for the ride this time, because we're going to need you. So thanks again for being here.
But of course.
We will jump into talking about the Marvel comics that hit the newsstands in April of 1967 in just a bit. But first, let's start out as we always do and establish a little historical context for the month that these issues came out. Rob, would you like to kick us off?
I would, as I often do. So in 1967, on April 1st, Radio Zurich, a radio network in Switzerland, played an April Fool's Day joke on thousands of its listeners by frequently interrupting regular programming with bulletins about an American manned landing on the moon. Even the American consulate in Zurich called the UPI News Bureau in an attempt to confirm the story. The gag was especially successful because at the time, no newspapers in Switzerland published weekend editions, and television did not start broadcasting until 6 p.m. So you get just a big blank of information and then just go to town on your prank. Yeah.
Well, 3 days after that, on the 4th of April, In a speech titled Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. denounced U.S. involvement in Vietnam and related his own discussions with African Americans in the past several months. Part of his speech read, "I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without first having spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, our own government." Which, yeah, like so many things that we cover in this section, it's uncanny how relevant that seems, you know, more than 50 years after it was first said.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Speaking of that, on the 6th of April, Bill Baird, an advocate for reform of restrictions against birth control, was arrested in front of 2,500 people at an auditorium at Boston University shortly after announcing that he would challenge Massachusetts state law. Baird handed a can of spermicidal foam and a condom to a 19-year-old student and was taken off the stage by Boston police, who charged him with providing contraceptives to a minor, distributing medicines without a pharmacist or medical license, and, quote, illegally exhibiting an obscene object. Baird would fight his conviction to the U.S. Supreme Court, which would reverse the lower courts. But, of course, he had to fight that. That's a different time.
Yeah.
That hopefully we don't get to go back to. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Although I also have to say that as a native son of New England, I'm not shocked that that happened in Boston. It's like, it might have a reputation as being more liberal now, but, you know, it was still founded by Puritans. Let's see. Oh, on the very same day, the 6th of April, 1967, The City on the Edge of Forever, a fan favorite episode of Star Trek, I would say maybe the fan favorite episode of Star Trek, written by Harlan Ellison, was telecast for the first time.
On the 10th of April, oral arguments began in the landmark Supreme Court case Loving versus Virginia, challenging Virginia's criminalization of interracial marriage. Two attorneys from the American Civil Liberties Union appeared on behalf of Richard Loving, a white man, and his wife Mildred Jeter Loving, an African-American woman. The court would rule unanimously in favor of the Lovings on June 12th, and interracial marriage would become legal in all of the United States. But yep. Until then, wasn't.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Not necessarily, yeah. I have always loved that the people who overturned the ban on interracial marriage in the United States, their last name was Loving. Mm-hmm. I think that you can't write that. That's great.
It's like Otto Octavius becoming Dr. Octopus, except, yeah. You know, historically extremely significant and a necessary step toward any sort of fairness in the world, as opposed to just like robot octopus arms, which are cool in their own way, but like less important.
Right. On the 15th of April, a group of 20 U.S. servicemen marched at the forefront of a parade of 100,000 protesters who marched from New York Central Park to the United Nations Plaza behind a banner reading Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And this marked the first time that American veterans were prominently featured in anti-Vietnam War protests. So it wasn't just a bunch of filthy hippies like us. When the New York marchers reached Sheep Meadow in Central Park, a group of protesters set fire to an American flag, and this prompted Congress to pass the first federal prohibition against flag burning, which would be a political football that we would kick around for the next 11 jillion years.
So I've got a couple things to take us through here. On April 28th, 1967, world heavyweight boxing champion Muhammad Ali refused to take the oath of induction into the United States Army after reporting as scheduled to an induction center in Houston, Texas. Ali stood in line with 11 other inductees, underwent a physical examination, blood tests, and x-rays, but refused to step forward when his name was called. He said he understood the penalties and said that his refusal was based on his religious beliefs. Ali was stripped of his boxing title on the same day by the World Boxing Association and would not be allowed to fight for the title again until 1970. On June 20th, Ali would be convicted of draft evasion, fined $10,000, and sentenced to 5 years in prison, but the conviction would be overturned by the U.S. Supreme Court on June 28th, 1967, which is pretty fast. You got an 8-day turnaround up to the courts. And then just a quick couple things for Beatles by the month. So just jumping back to the 7th, They were finishing up Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, but Paul had the concept for Magical Mystery Tour while he was filming Jane Asher. Paul said, so the idea tumbled together that we'd hire a bus, take a bunch of people out, and start trying to make up something about a magical mystery tour. It used to just be called a mystery tour up north. When we were kids, you'd get on a bus and you didn't know where you were going, but nearly always it was Blackpool. So
what a terrible mystery.
Yeah. He said, I feel like this is the same way that Peter Jackson did the Hobbit movies. He's like, all right, everybody get on the bus. We'll figure it out as we go. Right.
And then later that month, Paul performed on the Beach Boys album, Vegetables, which isn't that well known. And I'll tell you why. While hanging with Jane in America, he went to a recording session with Michelle Phillips from the Mamas and the Papas. She was going in to record with Brian Wilson for their album. He sat in the control room with Brian Wilson to help out. Paul's contribution ended up being him chewing celery. So the sound of Paul chewing celery is on Beach Boys album Vegetables. And things were just getting weird in the late 60s. You know, Zappa's busy making his second album with the Mothers of Invention right now, too. It's getting weird.
So there's a summary of some of the things that were happening in April of 1967. We're going to take our first break of the episode, and then when we come back, we're going to talk about some Marvel comics here on Marvel by the Month.
All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We're going to cover three of the issues that Marvel published in April 1967 in detail, but here's a quick look at everything else Marvel published this month that wasn't a fashion or cowboy comic. Avengers number 41, the Avengers and their freeloading housemate Hercules face Diablo and Dragon Man, who fly off with Wasp and Goliath at the end of the cliffhanger issue.
And Diablo's got a new look. He looks a little bit like the Mandarin. In fact, I read this issue when I was falling asleep, and I was like, why is the Mandarin got the Dragon Man? Because apparently I had stopped being able to process words.
Yeah. Diablo and the Dragon Man are characters. There are many characters that I only know from Marvel trading cards, and those are two. So I know what they look like. I may recall like their energy projection numerical powers, and I don't know anything about their continuity.
Yep.
That's probably fine. Yeah. I mean, Dragon Man does a little more in Fantastic Four and Future Foundation and stuff later, but Silver Age, he's just this, you know, MacGuffin of a villain. Several more. Daredevil number 29, the Masked Marauder, is gone finally, but his mob is still out there giving Daredevil a hard time on the orders of their new boss, who is called Boss. Sergeant Fury number 43, the Howlers reinforce allied forces in North Africa and hand Erwin Rommel his most crushing defeat.
And historically, this story is set right before Rommel goes back to Berlin and leads basically a coup against Hitler, or attempts to. Maybe he's not successful.
There was some sympathetic remarks about Rommel in the end of the Sergeant Fury comic. It was very weird. Strange Tales number 158. Nick Fury tricks Hydra into eliminating Baron Strucker and detonating their death spore inside their own airtight snow globe base, while Dr. Strange debates metaphysics with the Living Tribunal. That one is pretty trippy. Tales of Suspense number 91, Iron Man crushes a new baddie named The Crusher just in time to congratulate Happy Hogan and Pepper Potts on their engagement.
Which, you know, if you only know them through the Marvel Cinematic Universe, that probably comes as a little bit of a curveball.
Yes. Meanwhile, Captain America clears his good name and tries in vain to convince the Red Skull to abandon his ship before it explodes, which the Red Skull does not.
Right. So that's probably it for the Red Skull.
Yeah, we'll never hear from that guy again.
I've heard the name from old Silver Age stories, but I guess he just never went anywhere.
Yeah, no.
Just fizzled out. Tales to Astonish number 93, the Hulk and Silver Surfer knock each other around for 10 pages. And Namor survives the threat of the radioactive undersea giant called It. Basically, anybody writing a villain in any of the anthology titles is just like I don't know, what does it do? Name it that. And that's what they do every time. lately. So Thor number 141, the God of Thunder, defeats an alien robot named Replicus, thanks to the heroic sacrifice of a gangster named Slugger Sykes, who likes gardenias.
That's what happens if a minor character gets a spelled out name, and if they get like one character trait that's vaguely sympathetic, oh, they're screwed. You know they're screwed.
Yeah. Yep. Might as well just put a red shirt on him.
Yep.
Yeah, so that's a summary of the issues that we're not going to go deep on in this episode. But I would like to take us on a tour of Fantastic Four number 64, if you would be so kind as to indulge me in that.
I wish to indulge you.
All right. Well, this one's called The Sentry Sinister. It's written by Stan Lee. The art is by Jack Kirby with Joe Sinnott. After Sue finally confronts Reed about the way he's been treating her ever since they were married, Reed promises to make it up to her with a romantic getaway to a completely random location with his college roommate. The island that Ben chooses by throwing a dart at a map just so happens to be where the alien race known as the Kree set up a spaceport thousands of years ago. The Kree sentry guarding it wakes up when a couple of archaeologists begin poking around, and it's on high alert when the FF arrive. Once again, as we have seen many times before, the Fantastic Four don't so much manage to defeat their enemy as survive it. Johnny winds up overloading the power supply beneath the island and triggers a chain reaction that blows everything up. And the FF rescue the archaeologists and teleport out of there with Crystal and Lockjaw just before the whole thing blows sky high, with the sentry remaining at its post until the very end. That's pretty much the high points of what happened in there. Miles, are you how big of a Fantastic Four fan are you?
The FF are a group that I always liked. I always enjoyed when they cross over with X-Men or something, but I was focusing so hard on X-Men that I felt like I couldn't let myself get too into the other Marvel sub-franchises. I only had so much allowance, after all. but yeah, I mean, the FF are my dad's favorite comics. He was the one that got me into comics, so I know a lot about them, but I've read surprisingly little. This was fun as hell. I appreciate just how both straightforward and continually engaging this issue is. Like, that's something that the chemistry Lee and Kirby had. There's just this propulsive element to all of it, where you can't get bored, because as soon as one scene is finishing, the other scene has already half started. I also really, really appreciated just how almost romance comic-y some elements of FF can be in this era. Like, that seems to be something that Kirby excels at staging-wise. Just the slightly over-the-top fight and immediate resolution that Reed and Sue have about overwork versus, okay, now we need to go on a vacation, while the thing is carrying this giant piece of Kirby machinery nonsense. Yes. It's just straight-up delightful. And, you know, even the fight scene, like, you get, which is a large portion of the issue between the FF and the Sentry, it's like dinner and a show. Not only are we seeing lots of punching and lots of Kirby dynamic figures, we're also getting so much explanation from Stan Lee as to what is happening at any given time. Some people don't like that. I say, hey, why show or tell? Let's just get some and going on here.
And I think Lee is sort of backing off at this point. Like, he's cutting down his words a little bit, doing a little, let's say, editing. it's because this normally would, he's just giving Kirby a little more space, but he's still doing quite a bit of writing here. Mr. Fantastic sort of shows up in a fight again. He does that occasionally. It's always odd because I don't expect him to be really solving the problem, other than running off to a lab and coming back with something and solving the problem. It's sort of like Professor X brain blasting people. It's just, give him a minute, he's going to take care of this. There were some beautiful underwater scenes again. I'm loving the way Kirby does just these shots of underwater, where he kind of has the Kirby crackles, but they're defining the, you know, bubbles basically in the water. Yeah. Too. Mm-hmm. So there's some great shots with that too. And then yeah, there's Johnny and Crystal.
Yeah. So the whole, like, Johnny and Crystal subplot. So just to give some backstory here, they have spent like the last literally dozen issues trying to reconnect. So they met right before the Galactus first appearance. And then the Inhumans were sort of sealed away in their great refuge and they couldn't figure out how to get out. And that just recently happened. So this is like literally the first time they've had a chance to, you know, like be together in the same place. And this is like as horny as the Marvel Universe has gotten so far. Like it's really obvious that these teenage kids are really into each other.
They've also been left alone. Like,
yeah,
Ben left with Reed and Sue. They've got the Baxter building to themselves. You know, yep. Triton took off. They're just like, go ahead, have a party, do whatever you want, kids. Yeah.
Be safe. I mean, I can't give you birth control because I'll be arrested, but you know.
Bringing it back. I mean, they do have Lockjaw as a chaperone, and it turns out that becomes quite relevant. Just as things are heating up, giant alien, well, not alien exactly, giant dog from the moon.
Right. Yeah. Lockjaw kind of rhymes with cock block, so it works. But so that's kind of cool. I don't know, just to see like teenagers acting like teenagers, which was not a thing that you really saw in comics of the time. Like, you know, like all the teen sidekicks in the DC comics were just like, you know, they were little Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts who just wanted to, you know, grow up to be their mentors, basically. Like, you know, they were very straight laced and very, you know, straight arrow. Whereas you actually get to see, you know, these kids like having fun and being into each other and, you know, having hormones. And it's as good as that read to me. Reed as a husband reads just terribly. Like we've talked about this so many times, but Reed is the worst husband in the Marvel universe. Like,
yeah.
And this is a thing that literally the issue after they got married, Reed just starts treating Sue like the hired help, and not like the hired help as if someone appreciated the hired help. It's mm-hmm. just sort of like she just becomes kind of like his emotional dumping ground. Like her role in this is basically to keep him from doing all the things he wants to do. And then he just gets mad at her. And that's it. So yeah.
This is something we talk about when we talk about the Silver Age and explain the X-Men, actually, because I think you see this problem a lot in the Silver Age, which is yep. that you have, you know, the character with this power and backstory, the character with this power and backstory, the character with this power and backstory, and the girl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what the Invisible Woman, it seems, gets here. Certainly Jean Grey early on in X-Men, like she's largely defined by being the female member of the team rather than yeah. very much all that more specific. And I don't know if that's the case with like the Wasp and the Avengers at the time, but... Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, Stan Lee, obviously, a lot of great ideas, did a lot of amazing things. Writing women maybe is not his greatest strength.
Yeah. I mean, he writes female characters like what he is, which is a guy in his mid-40s writing in the mid-60s. If you watch Mad Men, you know how one-dimensional the male gaze was as far as women were concerned.
I do have to wonder how that would have come off in the 60s. Like, I actually wrote this line down because it blew me away. At one point during the fight with the Sentry, as things are getting started, he tells Sue, "Just do as I told you, girl, and don't question my orders. This isn't yeah. your husband talking. It's Mr. Fantastic, the leader of the world's greatest team." It's like, dude, you just dismissed your wife and talked yourself up within the same speech bubble. That is efficient right there.
Right.
Like, is he supposed to come off as such a dick to Sue and in general? I don't know.
Yeah, that sounded pretty much like a 90s rap lyric. Just like, I put down the lady I'm with, and then I talk about how great I am. You know, it's just, I was shocked by that. And we have Stockholm Syndrome. We don't get too shocked by 60s misogyny or other, even some overt racism. We're expecting it, a little braced for it. But, so this one kind of caught me off guard, and the beginning definitely caught me off guard, but I was happy that Sue said, "You've been treating me, you know, basically like your emotional dumpster since we got married, knock it off." And that, so that, you know, two panel switch to "we're going on vacation." It's just crazy.
For a moment, it seemed like she was going to, like, this is going to be the start of something new. And then it's like, okay, well, I guess we're still here.
Yep.
So leaving aside Reed and Sue's love life, because, you know, the closer you look at that, the worse things get. I thought one thing that was that I really got out of this issue and really appreciated about this issue, it's the first mention of the Kree. So now it's the first time we know that this is an alien race that existed. And we've had sort of, you know, like random aliens show up on Earth before, and they're usually like one and done, you know, Daredevil or whoever like convinces them to go back to their home planet. We never see them again, but the Kree are going to be a big deal. And I feel like we're kind of set up to feel like they're going to be a big deal in this issue. Like it feels a little bit more substantial. You know, we've got the Kree Sentry being there. There's obviously like they had an outpost established. They were doing something on Earth thousands of years ago. So it's like you're getting this first glimpse of them building in some history, and they do wind up being like a major characters in the Marvel universe. They turn out to be the race that created the Inhumans. The original Captain Marvel was Kree. And in fact, the destruction of the Sentry in this issue is one of the things that brings him to Earth. So you got that. And then, you know, not too many years down the road, we've got the Kree-Skrull War, which is a major Marvel storyline. So,
and then this many skirmishes with the Kree and the Shi'ar crossing into X-Men mythos. Mm-hmm. So yep. It's a huge piece of the universe. I think that they've been delving deeper into Doctor Strange's multidimensional realms than they have into the rest of the universe up to this point. So this is it's going to open a lot of stories from here to give us, you know, get all the way to Guardians of the Galaxy, to get all the way to the modern Captain Marvel. Everything, you know, this is the nugget that starts it.
That's one of the things I really enjoy about reading Silver Age comics like this. Like, so many ideas that came out basically anytime after the 90s just could not get traction. But here we're seeing almost every one of these issues, there's at least a little bit of something that's going to define hundreds of other issues going forward. Right. And it's just exciting to be there for the, holy crap, really, that right there, that panel's where it started, huh?
Right.
Yep. Well, that's actually a great transition to the next issue that I'd love to talk about. I mean, talk about, like, you know, holy crap, that's where that started. Amazing Spider-Man number 50, I think, has a few of those moments in it. So let's go ahead and take a break. And when we come back, we will talk about Spider-Man No More here on Marvel by the Month.
And we're back on Marvel by the Month with Spider-Man No More. This is written by Stan Lee, art by John Romita. The story starts off right in the middle of the action with Spidey beating up a gang of robbers in an office building. But the people he rescued are split between grateful and terrified of him because of his, J. Jonah Jameson's work on besmirching his profile.
So this is the first time in the issue that Spidey starts having overt second thoughts about, like, boy, maybe being Spider-Man's not all it's cracked up to be. Make sure we count these as we go.
Yeah, they really,
there's a few of them.
And he's done this many times in previous issues, but he doesn't really harp on it as much as he does here. So Peter Parker returns home to learn that Aunt May has suffered yet another health scare. He rushes to her bedside and beats himself up for Spider-Manning around when she needed him.
So there's two. He's like, oh, if only I wasn't Spider-Man, I could have been by Aunt May's side because I have a medical degree or something. I don't know. Like, I'm not quite sure what he thought he was going to do, but
I don't know. It's pretty, you know, religious level of guilt he carries for anything, but that's part of his character. So at school, kindly Professor Warren, who certainly won't turn out to be a total creep or anything, warns Peter that his grades are slipping. And on his way home, he has to decline Gwen's invite. Oh, yeah, that's three. So his grades are slipping. So Peter beats himself up about that, needs to study more. And he gets like the, you know, Peter, you came in with the best grades I've ever seen. And now you're, you know, just phoning it in. On his way home, he has to decline Gwen's invite to a get together she's hosting that night. So that's four.
We're up to four now. So four good reasons not to be Spider-Man.
At home, Peter sees another of Jonah Jameson's rants against Spidey. Not only does he decide he's had enough, but he really starts to believe what J. Jonah Jameson is saying about Spider-Man. It's like this negging that, like, he's like, maybe I am just terrible and a menace. So he walks out in the rain and tosses his Spidey suit in the trash.
Yeah, it's a very, very famous image. I feel like that and the cover, I feel are images that you see referenced a lot. Not even just in superhero comics, but I feel like in comics art generally, like those two are always being referenced by other artists.
Yeah, this is like the Spider-Man equivalent of that first X-Men Days of Future Past cover that you just see over and over and over, or the one from After the Dark Phoenix Saga of Cyclops walking sadly away from the X-Men.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly.
So it's a defining moment for Spider-Man. Also, this is his thing. He throws his suit in the trash. The next day, a kid finds it and brings it to an overjoyed Jonah, who rewards him with a free copy of the Daily Bugle.
Such a wonderful character note, yeah. Right there.
He's just terrible.
I really do believe that Stan has more fun writing Jonah Jameson than any other character he writes, which, as we've also mentioned on the show before, apparently Steve Ditko created Jonah Jameson as a parody of Stan Lee. So so the fact that if whether Stan is in on the joke or not just makes that story so much better.
Spidey's retirement is the talk of the town at this point, and Jonah even gets an invite to the Tonight Show. So we've got Ed McMahon holding up the costume and Johnny commenting, but with Spider-Man retired, a new crime lord named, probably we'll never hear about, but the Kingpin makes his move to consolidate leadership of all the city's gangs. And he's not the only one. Old Frederick Foswell decides that maybe he's going to come back to a life of crime because it's a better deal than working as a reporter for J. Jonah Jameson.
Yes. Yeah. Frederick Foswell was the big man, the leader of the enforcers, the crime lord in the early days of Spider-Man comics. He got unmasked by Spidey, I think in Spider-Man number 10, 9 or 10, and then went to prison. Supposedly went straight, got hired back by J. Jonah, and has seemed to be on the straight and narrow since then. Although he does have an alter ego who he disguises. Is it
Patch?
Is it Patch? It's Patch. I always confuse Patch and Matches Malone, but that's Bruce Wayne's alter ego. Yeah.
And don't confuse Patch with Logan, because then we get even way confused. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then we're off in Madripoor. Yeah.
So he's been sort of like, you know, hanging out in the underworld, but he's been doing it to, you know, gather information for his crime reporting. But now it seems like, you know, it's like, you know, he's like a guy who quit smoking, but he just keeps a pack of cigarettes on him, you know, in case like his friends at the bar need a smoke. So it's like, oh, I don't know if that's a good idea, Fred.
Yeah. Or in his case, he keeps a rubber mask with him. I'm always impressed by how effective rubber masks are in Silver Age comics. Like, you're wearing one, your disguise is flawless. Throw a trench coat on over that, and there is no possible way anyone will discover you.
And at this point in the story, we get what I like to call Peter Parker, the spectacular Peter Parker. We get a montage of several pages of Peter Parker totally relaxed and happy for the very first time, while the city descends into crime and chaos. Just constant. He's just like walking by, headlines, people yelling, TV's on, everyone's worried about what's going on, and he's just, I'm Peter Parker doing my homework. I'm Peter Parker, turns out to music. Yeah.
New York City, a city of, you know, what, at this point, 6 million people. And, you know, with tens of thousands of law enforcement professionals. Apparently the only thing keeping all of New York City from descending immediately into crime and chaos was one guy swinging around in spandex. Yeah.
So he's, of course, struggling with his great sense of responsibility and trying hard not to use his great power. Finally, he cracks. He sees a watchman being attacked on a rooftop. I said watchman, I'll just say it. If I say watchman, it sounds like it's the name of a villain. he sees a watchman being attacked on a rooftop. He dashes up there without costume and then just punches everybody so fast they can't quite see him. And he rescues the Watchman, who is the spitting image of Uncle Ben. It takes him a little bit to process that. Triggers a flashback to the origin story from Amazing Fantasy number 15. And Peter realizes that he can't stop being Spider-Man, no matter what sacrifice it means to himself.
And I think this might be the first time that John Romita has drawn the Spider-Man origin in a flashback. So it's like we're getting, you know, I mean, it's the same story, but it's like, you know, it's a slightly beefier Spidey and a little bit more, I don't know how you describe it, but like a little bit more over the top. It's more dramatic, I think.
Yeah, we get different angles with,
yeah,
than we've seen when it recurred in the early origin and early stories for Spider-Man. So
yeah.
Even if Ditko redrew panels for a flashback, it was still pretty similar. And this is just sort of a different take.
Yep.
So from here, we cut to the Kingpin's office where Frederick Foswell is seriously overplaying his hand. He comes in and, you know, it says he was going to take over and make Kingpin make Kingpin one of his lieutenants. So Kingpin zaps Foswell's pistol with a disintegrator beam built into his cane. Foswell like snuck a gun in his hat, and Kingpin says, "We already knew you had the gun. Here's my, you know, disintegrator ring. Try
you
to
brought
that.
A gun to a disintegrator ray fight." What an idiot.
Then he has Foswell put on ice, which is different from having him iced. So hopefully Kingpin's goons understand the subtle differences of icing. So the issue ends with Peter Parker sneaking into J. Jonah Jameson's office to recover his Spidey costume. When JJJ shows up the next day, Spidey's sitting behind the desk and tells him that he's back and he's going to have to write some retractions again. Jonah is once again beside himself as Spidey swings out the window with a new sense of purpose to be continued. So it was this was a roller coaster. We go through all the counts of him finding reasons to not be Spider-Man. And it looks like that might be a thing that's going to happen for a bit. But we get all the way back to, I must be Spider-Man by the end of the story.
Which I'm sure came as a total shock to all of us reading this issue that, you know, he would ultimately decide that actually maybe being Spider-Man is the correct choice.
I would have welcomed like 12, well, let's say 4 issues of just Peter Parker avoiding doing anything as Spider-Man. That would be hilarious.
Just wall crawling away in his civvies from the slightest sign of trouble.
Yeah. Yes. But yeah, I mean, this, and they've been leading up to this issue for at least a half dozen issues prior to this. So I feel like almost every issue lately has ended with Peter like explicitly, you know, talking to himself in his bedroom with his head hung low, like just, oh, my life is so terrible and it's all Spider-Man's fault. So not like this comes as a surprise, but it's definitely something that, you know, they have been leading up to. I think Spider-Man is one of the better planned Marvel books at this point in the history of the company. I think Stan and Romita have a pretty good idea of where they're going over the next few issues at any given time.
Yeah, this one, it just seemed so clean and deliberate and efficient in its storytelling. Like, and this is coming from me. I haven't read the issues that have led up to this. And in fact, I'm kind of surprised that it was to be continued because it's just so beautifully self-contained, aside from, you know, the Kingpin being introduced.
Right.
But yeah, I was extremely impressed with this issue. Like the emotional arc really, really worked for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is it's tightly written. It feels like a movie that somebody agonized over the script, like just cutting it, getting it, hitting the beats, getting everything organized, encapsulated, which is, yeah, you're right. To say to be continued after this, it's like, what? Well, yeah, there will be another issue, but does it feel like we need this is a continuing saga? It feels wrapped up right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And talking about the intro of the Kingpin, I think one of the things I was kind of astounded by going back and reading this is just how like completely formed the Kingpin was, like from his debut. Like this is essentially the same Kingpin who's in Marvel Comics in 2020. You know, he's a crime boss. He prefers to not be directly involved with anything, but operate sort of from the shadows and through intermediaries. I mean, I don't think he has a disintegrator cane anymore, which is too bad. But I mean, that's really the only like kind of silly superhero-y thing about this character. And this is not the sort of character that we have really seen in Marvel Comics up to this point.
It's certainly not Spider-Man. Like Kingpin is not animal themed for one. So right. That's weird.
I always forget how many characters started out as Spider-Man spinoff characters, that like the Kingpin was in fact not a Daredevil character initially, right. He was a Spider-Man right. character, that the Punisher showed up as a Spider-Man villain, if I recall correctly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I guess that makes sense. I mean, this was the, in some ways, flagship book of Marvel Comics for the most of the history of Marvel Comics.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned this before, but like it's pretty obvious that Spider-Man is the book that Stan is putting his best effort into, and Fantastic Four is the book that Kirby is putting his best effort into. So it's like those two always seem to really, you know, rise to the top. But yeah, like, and talking about, you know, Kingpin probably now being more associated as a Daredevil villain, I think that just goes to show, like, there were so many good ideas coming out of Spider-Man at this point. Like, one book could not contain them all. So it's like, yeah, you need to give Daredevil a bump. It's like, well, have him tussle with a Spider-Man villain. That'll raise his profile, you know? Mm-hmm. And Kingpin is a great, great street level villain. You know, like, he's the perfect foe for all of Marvel's New York based street characters, you know, because he's a very realistic threat. He doesn't need superpowers to be a menace. He just has to, you know, exploit the systems that are already crushing everybody. So it's like, yeah. And now he's just better at it than anyone else.
Hmm. That sounds very timely as well.
Yes.
boy, howdy.
Yeah. I don't know. Sociopathic, mob connected New Yorkers who rise to tremendous power in real estate dealings. Yeah, you can see that.
scary. Who then later could, you know, gets, I know for quite a while, he was the mayor of New York in the comics arcs. And I don't know if he became governor ever, but he rose to political power. Who could have fathomed that?
I mean, I'll give Kingpin one thing. At least he's competent. So
yeah,
you may not true. Like him. But.
And, you know, honestly, as far as Kingpin goes, I really have to respect the confidence of a man who wears a white suit jacket.
Yeah.
Like, that's a guy, he's literally not afraid that he's going to get anything on him.
And he's still like sumo-ish big. So he takes up space. You know, soup could fall anywhere. so that is confidence.
Yes.
That's actually one thing I really love about the Kingpin's design in general. So I guess credit to Romita, who presumably was the one that designed him for this issue. Like, you don't often see very large characters who are primarily thinkers or manipulators.
Right.
And I think that's one of the things that makes the Kingpin work, is he's got this aura of intimidation just based on his physicality that carries over perfectly to the areas where he's really intimidating. Also, he's got a disintegrator cane, but like you guys said, that's not really a thing later.
Yeah. I mean, he's a threat just sitting behind a desk, but when he gets up, you know that it's like, oh man, I'm in for it. It is time to cover off on our last issue of the episode. It's actually going to be a two-issue arc. This is X-Men number 32 and 33, which features the second appearance of the Juggernaut. The stories are called Beware the Juggernaut, My Son, and Into the Crimson Cosmos. They are both written by Roy Thomas, with art by Werner Roth, inked by John Tartaglione. Miles, jump in anywhere here, because
oh, I shall.
I will admit I struggled with these issues, like not comprehending them, but comprehending maybe some of the thinking behind them. So we'll just go ahead and get rolling here. So our story begins with a very strange splash page. It's the silhouette of the Juggernaut kind of looking in at the window of the Coffee A-Go-Go, the coffee shop where Beast and Iceman often hang out. And it's such a bizarre image that the first caption of the issue is literally an explanation of what we're looking at. So it's Bobby Drake's 18th birthday, and all of the ex-kids are here, as well as some local beatniks from the Coffee A-Go-Go. I hope Bobby's girlfriend Zelda has not gotten her hopes up about this being Bobby's 18th birthday, because she's going to be disappointed on a number of levels if that's the case.
That she will. Yeah. Bobby's the subtext that would eventually lead to Bobby coming out. You could certainly put a vote in for this being one of the early kernels of that.
Yes, I think so. The party's just getting started at the Coffee A-Go-Go. Meanwhile, creepy Professor X reveals what he's been hiding behind a locked door in the X mansion that we have seen over the last few issues. It's his stepbrother, Kane Marco, aka the Juggernaut. And the prof is determined to find a way to restore Kane to being just a regular old non-powered jerk. Yeah, Miles, you all have talked a little bit about Professor X and sort of his problematic early years. is this fairly in keeping with your exhaustive research?
Absolutely. Professor Xavier, I would say, loves two things more than anything else. One is faking three things. One is faking his own death. The second is just randomly erasing people's minds if they give him any trouble whatsoever. And the third is keeping unnecessary secrets. And so here we have a great example of number three that maybe ties into number two, because as you guys have covered, you know, he did essentially turn off his brother's mind in the Juggernaut's last appearance.
Yeah. Yep.
And so, yeah, like, could he have told his X-Men what was going on here to prevent a great deal of trouble? Absolutely. But at the same time, that paternalism with Professor X, it at least fits his character. He seems to at least tell himself that he's keeping his students safe from this information. Not a good call in my personal opinion, but I will say it's at least consistent. So I have to give Professor X points for that.
All right. Well, back at the Coffee A-Go-Go, a motorcycle gang named Satan's Saints literally crashes the party on their hogs because Zelda turned down their leader, Rocky Rhodes, for a date.
And you said you didn't like this issue. Look at this.
This is the part. Like, if there's any highlights from this issue, this is absolutely, it's like, biker gang crashing a Greenwich coffee shop where some teenagers are celebrating their birthday. This is the best. This is a highlight of the two issues as far as I'm concerned.
And there's enough room for them to fully drive around inside of this coffee shop, harassing everyone. And it feels very much like the very first Mad Max movie. Like it does feel like that menacing biker gang. But I still was like, how did they get in and how are they driving around in here? I need to not think about this too hard. I need to just let the story go. But I've seen motorcycles driven even onto a stage before and it looked very precarious. So I'm feeling like these are expert motorcyclists that we're seeing here.
They don't just let anybody into Satan's Saints. You have to be good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Satan's Saints is just, I mean, obviously it's Hell's Angels, right? But like, that's a great name for a motorcycle gang. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. Like that might be better than Hell's Angels.
Yeah. You have the alliteration. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Got the SS thing too, which I know there are some motorcycle gangs out there that really like that sort of thing. So, yeah. So of course the X kids surreptitiously use their powers to take out all of the Saints. And we are now almost halfway through the issue. And basically not a goddamn thing has happened. <It's> like, I mean, other than a motorcycle gang crashing a birthday party at a coffee shop, which I concede is a really awesome thing. But, you know, we were promised a Juggernaut on this cover and all we have seen him do is sit in a chair unconscious. So, you know, I'm feeling like I want my 12 cents back. Back at the X mansion, Professor X has plugged his and Juggernaut's brains into an Energo transformer.
Yeah.
To rid Juggs of the spell of Cytorak, because, and this is a thing that I often forget, but Juggernaut is not a mutant. He is a magical being. So he is technically powered by the same type of magic that Doctor Strange and his friends are, they use. So Professor X is trying to use his science to remove magic. Unsurprisingly, it doesn't go great. Everything goes terribly wrong. Juggernaut not only wakes up, but now he has Professor X's mental abilities as well.
And that to me, being very familiar with X-Men, sounds like we just went through this phase in Fantastic Four where there was the Silver Surfer powered Doctor Doom, the cosmic Doom, which sounds like a universe eraser. And if you give the Juggernaut Professor X's powers, that is again a thing where I'm like, well, that's it for the good guys. Those are those kinds of stakes. We know that we already know that Professor X is immeasurably powerful. And we know that the Juggernaut is as well. So he's got the brain power and the brawn power combined. So I was now willing to, you know, cede my 12 cents to see where this goes.
The rest of this issue should be, you know, a no-brainer for the Juggernaut, right? Like, he should just be able to overwhelm everybody and destroy them immediately. It's not exactly how things play out. So the X-Men, they get back to the mansion. Angel flies around in the dark for no reason for a while, looking for the professor. Finally, someone figures out that they can just turn the lights on, and they discover that someone has turned the mansion's defenses against them, including stairs that turn into a ramp.
I love that that's like the big defense mechanism that we focus on in this issue. Like, the danger room exists at this point. It's not what it will later be with all the Shi'ar hard light holograms and stuff. Yeah. But no, it's stairs that then you fall down them because they turn into a ramp. And that's just so deliciously Silver Age that I have to love it, even if I will certainly grant that it makes no goddamn sense.
Yep.
that's like the big threat.
It's like a Laurel and Hardy bit or something. You know, it's very, very old timey.
And also, like, we have the Juggernaut, unstoppable force of destruction, with the mental powers of the most powerful telepath on Earth. And he's dicking around turning stairs into ramps.
He like took the time to figure out all the switches. You know, he's like, yeah, you know, I could just brain blast them to oblivion or punch them or whatever. But instead, I'm going to, I really want to know how this room is set up, man. Yeah, it's going to take some time.
I feel like if you're all powerful and you know you're all powerful and that your victory is assured, like, have some fun with it on the way. You know, you don't want to end things too quickly.
That's true.
I may be going about this wrong. Like, I was approaching this as if Roy Thomas has no idea what makes the Juggernaut a great character, but really, I see now what he's doing is he's adding an element of playfulness to the character that he didn't possess before. So he's really expanded the character, not mm-hmm. just completely missed the point.
Exactly.
So finally, on page 16, the Juggernaut finally steps out from behind the pile of crates where he was hiding. So Juggernaut uses Xavier's powers in ways that we have never seen Xavier use Xavier's powers to take out the X-Men, and does very, very little plowing through things with his head. And then after doing that, he gets a mental summons from Factor 3, which is the shadowy group that we have seen name dropped the last several issues. They want him to meet them in Europe. So he just takes off and leaves Xavier and the X-Men for dead. So that wraps up X-Men number 32. So off to a little bit of a shaky start.
You have to also say, for some reason, Werner Roth's depiction of the Juggernaut in these issues is weird. I can't quite place all the tiny things that are wrong with how he's drawing him, but he looks like a lower budget cosplay version, you know, still a big imposing guy with a giant weird helmet, but there's something garbage canny about his suit in itself. It's just there's something wrong with the dimensions or something about how he's drawn. So he looks comical, more comical than he did when he first appeared in both of these issues to me. So there's something non-threatening about the way he looks like a guy in a garbage can suit.
I know what you mean. Yeah, because I wonder if part of that is just that we're not seeing the Juggernaut do Juggernaut stuff here as much. And so much of the look of the Juggernaut is him in motion, in action, this just like wrecking ball barreling toward you. And so if he's just standing there pressing the turn the stairs into a ramp switch, it just the costume doesn't really work when it's not, you know, coming right at your face.
Yeah, you need some flying bricks and debris in front of him to sort of finish the costume. That ties it together. Yeah.
And you need his eye line to be like level with his shoulders. Like, he's just, you know, coming at you, you know, like he's just like constantly tackling. He's in a state of constant tackle.
He's the Marvel Universe's equivalent of Ram Man from He-Man.
That is perfect. Right.
Yep. Well, let's see if Juggernaut finally does some juggernauting in this next issue. So X-Men 33, he does at the very beginning, we do see him doing some Juggernaut things. He runs off some soldiers as he's plowing his way to the Metro aircraft plant. Back at the X-Mansion, Marvel Girl uses a mental wave amplifier to read Professor X's mind. and somehow this helps her learn the origin of the Juggernaut's power. So I guess Professor X figured out how the Ruby of Sidorak worked. And so she's acquiring this knowledge from Professor X's unconscious mind. So I think
Professor X gained that knowledge from Kane when they were Energo transforming.
Okay.
You know how it works with the Energo transformer. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. So we learn that the Ancient One from Doctor Strange, he was the one who discovered Sidorak's Ruby of the Crimson Bands. And after a magic fight with the Ruby's guardian, Zorak, the Ancient One trapped Zorak in the Ruby.
I feel like we should call him Xorak, you know, just because it does start with an X. And
true. Yeah. That would be more on brand.
For what it's worth, Chris Claremont says Xavier, and so probably it should be Xavier. But I'm just saying, I first discovered Professor X from Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, the old cartoon from like the late 70s, early 80s.
Oh, yeah.
And Stan Lee himself says Xavier in that one. And therefore, we're just going to go with it.
Yeah, I grew up, my brother and dad and I always said Xavier. So when it finally, you know, hit Xavier, even now it's amazingly hard for me to start with the X on his name. But I do for the Marvelites out there.
For professionalism.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We make the sacrifices we must.
So the X-Men feed the information that Marvel Girl acquired into Cerebro to try and use Cerebro to find the Ancient One. But Doctor Strange's astral form shows up instead, because as readers of Strange Tales know, the Ancient One has just been murdered by an extra dimensional being named Zom, by getting shoved into one of the stones of Stonehenge. So he's not available to take your call.
But he gave his power to the doc. Yeah.
Right. So Strange shows up. He takes a little astral break from his fight at Stonehenge, and he zaps the incantation that they need to resolve this dilemma into Cyclops and Marvel Girl's brains, and then transports them to the Temple of Sidorak. So this is actually kind of cool. I think this is the first time Doctor Strange has crossed over with the X-Men, and it's sort of like, you know, it's like we're seeing this now a lot with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, but you know, all these different aspects of the Marvel Universe, whenever you have like two different ones kind of collide, it's kind of interesting to see. It's like, oh yeah, so when, you know, when Doctor Strange is invoking the Crimson Bands of Sidorak, like that's the same thing that made the Juggernaut the Juggernaut. So like, that's kind of neat.
And I like this, there is this distinction where there can only be two people on this landing party. That two people that can go on this, and they quickly decide, everyone volunteers, of course, but Scott decides that Jean should come with him. And
yeah,
and that is, this is, I think the main piece of this whole story is just that moment. And then what happens after, for those two to go off alone on this mission, is what makes this comic or this whole storyline much more interesting to me. I mean, I love, you know, the Satan's saints, but this is the good part.
Yeah, it's kind of funny that like the Juggernaut is the least interesting part of this Juggernaut two-parter. But I agree. I mean, for me, the Scott and Jean thing is totally one of the centerpieces. Like, they've been pining after each other since basically X-Men number one. Mm-hmm. I mean, and using only their thought bubbles and not their word bubbles, because, you know, it's essentially a romance comic in that regard. And so, to see that as they reveal their feelings for each other in the most like stead, chaste, subtle, indirect way possible. And then for Scott to say like, oh no, if I need a partner on this mission, I'm going to be with not only the person I want to spend time with, but the person who I know is going to be good at this. Like, I appreciate that from the get-go of them being kind of sort of a couple, there's none of that like, oh no, well, I care too much about you, I have to keep you safe and away from the action. Which was, it's just so freaking common in Silver Age or even later comics to see that. So to see that level of mutual respect as part of their dynamic, even here, is great. Even if they're just getting transported to a weird magic-y dimension with no explanation.
It's putting, it's starting to put Jean's power in the class that it really is. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that a lot. She's saved them a few times, and they do, you know, she gets into battle with them pretty regularly, but there are still a few times where Jean is left out or Jean shows up separately. And this is where we notice that if there's only two people that can go, Jean is one of them, you know, and not just for smooches. It's for her power.
Also, I think it's worth noting that this is the only romance in the Marvel universe right now that's being written by someone other than Stan Lee. Roy Thomas has inherited some relationships in Avengers that, you know, he's kind of had them just kind of proceed along the way that they were defined by Stan. This is the first time he's actually putting two characters together and letting them sort of figure things out. And I think part of what we're seeing is the difference between a, you know, a guy in his mid 40s writing a teenage or, you know, young person relationship and a guy in his early to mid 20s writing that. And I think it's a generational shift. I really, that is also Satan Saints. And the relationship between the budding relationship between Cyclops and Marvel Girl are definitely two high points of this the story. Oh yeah, so they got to go into this Ruby. That's why they're there.
They got 1 hour to Ruby, of course. Yeah,
they got 1 hour to figure this thing out. Exorak is waiting for them inside there, so they got their work cut out for them. Then meanwhile, Juggernaut's he's just gotten to the aircraft plant. Beast, Iceman, and Angel arrive to slow him down. They start brawling. And then, you know, remember that whole thing where Juggernaut had Professor X's mental powers? Well, that's been totally forgotten. That never comes back in this issue. Yeah, no.
I think maybe I would like to just get a no prize by saying Juggernaut's helmet prevents him from using Professor X's power.
There you go. It's just sort of the razor bouncing back into his own head.
Telepathy can't get in or out. Okay.
Yeah.
Anyway, so inside the Ruby, Marvel Girl and Cyclops are down to 1 minute remaining. And they know this because they're looking at their watches. And as they do, they realize that Exorak flinches at the sound of their ticking watches. So Marvel Girl telekinetically chucks her watch at him and he ages to dust instantly. And they touch the Ruby and transport with it back to the X-Mansion. So now, as the other X-Men continue battling the Juggernaut at the aircraft plant, Cyclops and Marvel Girl show up with the Ruby, and its presence makes Juggernaut weaker, not stronger. Because he's a slow learner, I guess, he grabs it from them, and then he winds up trapped inside of it, and he becomes the new guardian of the Ruby, taking Exorak's place. So looks like everything's going to be totally okay. The X-Men return to the mansion in triumph, only to discover that Juggernaut was a distraction. Factor 3 just wanted to incapacitate Professor X and keep them busy so they could kidnap him. It's a cliffhanger. So there we go. Taken as a whole, I think we touched on a lot of points, you know, as we were going through it, but Miles, like, where does this fit in for you, in X-Men stories, like as far as Silver Age X-Men goes and things like that?
This one I'm really mixed on, because overall the story, I will agree, is not all that well put together. Like, the Juggernaut part just totally falls flat and is inconsistent. I do like the emotional development that we see of Scott and Jean, and I do like... So there's a bit of symbolism that it seems like Thomas is trying to go for and maybe doesn't fully land, but that I do enjoy. Like, so we were talking about how Exorak is eventually defeated because he gets hit in the face with a wristwatch. And on the one hand, that's really dumb. On the other hand, though, it does seem to be going into this duality that I think is inherent to Xavier and Juggernaut and is why those two characters work. Like, Professor X is a character who was born with these powers. He was born different. He suffered some discrimination. Well, also, he was really good at football for a while, but whatever, that's irrelevant. but he spent so much of his life grappling with, you know, essentially the Peter Parker question. Like, okay, if I have great powers, that means I have great responsibility. Kane Marco lucked into his powers. They're not inherent. They're not something he was born with. They were external and they were magical. And so in a way, that kind of like deliberate pondering of responsibility versus the just random luck and then lashing out with the powers you have, there seems to be this almost science magic parallel that's being lined up with that. Like, Marvel Girl at one point even mentions that her mental powers, the way they work against Exorak, it's because her powers are specifically science-based. Because these are the children of the Atom, you know? Like, these are characters who initially got their powers because their parents were around nuclear energy, even though nobody talks about that anymore. So that part interests me. I wish that part of the story had been told more clearly and better, But I think there is a cool concept right there amid all of the nonsense.
That's actually, yeah, I honestly was not giving it that much credit just because we are struggling through some of Roy Thomas's early scripting at this point. But at the same time, like, obviously there is a point where Roy Thomas becomes a very good comics writer. And maybe we're starting to see that now. That actually gives me a little bit of hope for the future, for the immediate future. I mean, I know by the time the early 70s roll around, Roy is great. And also I think, you know, I think any creative professional will tell you that the only way to get better at something is to just, you know, keep failing in public, basically. Mm-hmm. So that's a really interesting way to approach it. And to kind of understand, that stories like this have a place to play, not only in X-Men lore, but also in the development of artistic talent.
And this is another great crossover. It's Doctor Strange. I mean, not great. Doctor Strange story last month was woeful. Like, Fred Hembeck made appropriate fun of some of that stuff as we talked about it for last week's episode. But it does tie in directly to them trying to reach out to the Ancient One, them getting hold of Doctor Strange. Exactly. You know, the continuity is running relatively smooth. I don't know exactly what the monthly dates were on each of these issues, but again, they're doing a solid crossover with a character that you would never see coming to pop up in the X-Men comic. And it makes perfect sense because the Crimson Bands of Cytorak, you know, and Juggernaut's power. So this is that another nudge in that expansion and connection of the Marvel universe.
I think the next time we see Doctor Strange with the X-Men, or maybe the time after that, is when Nightcrawler's mom gets mad at him for not calling, essentially, and sends him into a version of Dante's Inferno that Doctor Strange has to help them through. That was a thing.
That's a great. I love the sort of religious ennui, or no, more of the religious angst and insanity that Nightcrawler goes through, puts himself through, and is put through. You know, it's a great story.
He was one of the main reasons that Excalibur was one of my favorite books for a long time. Like, just seeing him and Shadowcat hanging out and just doing their own thing that wasn't very X-Men related, but I just wanted to hang out with those characters.
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, back to this story here, which unfortunately does not feature Nightcrawler. we're a little early for that yet.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that's always been X-Men to me is the rotating cast, and you don't get that in the Silver Age. I mean, way later in the Silver Age, we'll see Havoc and Polaris kind of sort of join the team, but not really. But for the most part, it's the original five X-Men. At the same time, their dynamic is really fun. Like, yeah, they're more archetypes than characters in a lot of ways, but just seeing Beast and Iceman's goofy friendship, just seeing Angel bringing home a new girl every issue, which, by the way, his girlfriend that we meet in this issue, Candy Southern, is going to be like a really big deal in the Bronze Age. Mm-hmm. And then we'll suffer a truly tragic end twice.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Twice. I love that. Such an X-Men thing to say.
Oh, yeah. She gets decapitated by Warren's college roommate, and then she gets resurrected as an evil robot and kills herself to kill some other evil robots. It's not, you don't want to be Candy Southern. She goes through some problems. But yeah, you know, there's a part of me that really just does enjoy the utter goofiness of this era. The fact that, you know, we have this Satan Saints thing, the fact that we have these kids trying to keep their mutant powers secret in the form of fighting off bikers who just burst through a wall of the coffee shop they were in while a beatnik poet was reading poetry to their friend. Like, it's ridiculous, of course, but like, sometimes you want ridiculous, and sometimes you want ridiculous with characters that you know are going to become way better characters years in the future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's, I feel like, there's a number of Marvel comics that we have read where the superhero supervillain fight is the least important, least interesting, least incidental, you know, part of the story, the whole issue. But I think this is absolutely one of those stories where I think everything that happens that doesn't involve the Juggernaut, who is like probably one of my top 10 Marvel characters, everything outside of the Juggernaut related stuff is actually pretty interesting. It's just, when he gets involved, like I don't think I've ever read a comic where the addition of the Juggernaut made it a worse comic, but I think this might be the one.
Yeah. To the, and to Miles's point, this is like the goofy version of what Claremont does later and what becomes so intrinsic to the X-Men universe is that the superhero fight is not the thing that we're here for. Mm-hmm. And this is starting to form that idea where I'm like, yeah, let's let Jean and Cyclops hang out for a while in this Ruby and figure out themselves and and how much they trust each other and yeah. things, you know, just very simple little moments.
Exactly. Yeah. At the same time, though, I can't let this book off the hook for the Juggernaut thing, because how did they screw the Juggernaut up so badly in this story?
Yeah.
And with they doubled up his power. They gave him Xavier's power, and then they just totally leave it alone. Like, I feel like that could have been a 6-issue arc of, you know, of huge struggles and big stakes and lots of earth shattering things. And instead it just like, it literally gets just dropped in the middle of the story and forgotten. And we end up taking a character from being comatose and held by a stepbrother to being held inside of a Ruby. That is, you know, this we already know as a high stakes villain for the X-Men. So it's just bizarre.
In a way, it reminds me of the Onslaught era of X-Men from the mid to late 90s, in that you have this shadow of Factor 3 behind just everything that's going on in Silver Age X-Men at this point. We don't know who they are. We don't know what they want. We just know that they must be really badass because they keep like manipulating various villains and events in such effective ways. And just like in the Onslaught era, we see a lot of other characters who were cool characters be very much second fiddles to Onslaught. Like, their role is really only there so that they can show how much more badass the big bad is. Mm-hmm. So, in a way, like, I agree, Juggernaut with Xavier's powers would be such a phenomenal, fascinating threat, who, in a way, actually would be kind of like Onslaught now that I think about it. But, and I think that's a missed opportunity, absolutely. And instead, we just see him, you know, as this previously incredibly powerful villain whose main role now is to just make the reader understand, but Factor 3, they're the real threat. Buy the next issue and find out who they are.
Yeah. Well, maybe not the strongest story to end on, but we're going to turn that all around as we talk about our panels of the month this month. So we'll just go around the table and talk about a panel that stood out to us, that stuck with us after we finished reading the stories this month. So I'll go ahead and lead off with something from Fantastic Four, number 64. It's a kind of almost a throwaway panel, but it comes from page 4, panel 1. So this is when the archaeologists are exploring the island with the ancient Kree spaceport. And Kirby just does this. It's just like a third page horizontal panel showing the spaceport with just thousands of years of decay built up on it. And, you know, two things that I really love to see Kirby draw are space and cosmic things and very old things. And this just does a really it's a perfect combination of both of them. Like I mentioned earlier, I really feel like that issue did a good job of setting up that the Kree is not just, you know, kind of a one and done, like throwaway alien race, but they've been on Earth for a while. And we're going to be hearing more from them. And I feel like that is one of those panels that helped to really establish that. And it's just, you know, really good looking, fun to look at.
And pretty much established the full Ancient Aliens, you know, franchise from.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. right here, this panel, this where it started.
And everybody started going, yeah, probably aliens came here before and made something I can't explain right now because I don't want to read a lot of books. You know,
but yeah, that panel and just the Kree here in general, like this issue seeds that sense of mystery and history. So perfectly.
Yeah. Yeah. Mine is a totally different take and not one of the ones we did a deep dive into. In contrast to last month, Strange Tales number 158, mine is page 6, panel 1. This is the Doctor Strange story. This is just after we meet the Living Tribunal at the end of the last issue. And Marie Severin, everything seemed rushed, and Zom seemed like a really dumb character, and everything seemed just not dialed in. And this time, it seems like maybe they were putting all the time here, which is nice. It looks great. It was too bad we threw away the ancient one, into Stonehenge Rock last issue. But my specific panel is a big splash page of the Living Tribunal showing the destruction of the Earth to Doctor Strange, or what will happen because of what Doctor Strange did with the Forelock, which was... I don't even need to go into it, but he's essentially set off a chain reaction that's going to create more evil sorcerers upon Earth that will unravel the entire existence. So he's showing first the Earth just becoming, it's like these multi stages of the Earth. It's like showing a moon chart of, you know, all the stages of the moon, but it's the Earth growing into decay until it's just a sort of asteroid field of dust. And it's a very graphic page, and it's just beautiful. And Marie Severin has all this work where she pops up, and it seems like this could be the next big thing, or the next Ditko, you know, the next, you know, lieutenant to Kirby's, you know, captain. And it's just not, it just didn't come to pass for some reason, but it's, but this is a great example.
Oh man, I gotta read some Strange Tales, you said? That sounds amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Miles, do you have a panel of the month for this month?
I do. I agonized. As much as I love Bernard the Poet doing his A Birthday's Like a Comely Lass from Shadow Knight She Does Appear poem, I actually had to go with a panel from Spider-Man number 50.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow.
There is a panel on, I want to say, page 7 or 8 or something. It's right before Peter throws away his Spider-Man suit. And it's just a close-up panel of him with his head with his hand on the top of his head, his forehead sweating, his brow furrowed, staring into the middle distance, and just, you know, questioning whether, wait, am I insane for doing something like this? Is J. Jonah Jameson right? And it's kind of cheesy. I mean, we see menace, egomaniac, public enemy, fraud, mentally disturbed, like just these words in all different colors hovering in front of him. But Romita really does capture just that sense of utter existential crisis so perfectly, in addition to just being incredible at drawing facial expressions and body language. And so I have to go with that one. I'm so sorry, Bernard the Poet and Satan Saints. You had some great stuff, but I do appreciate a good existential crisis, and this one is excellent.
That's a great panel, which is a crisis about Spider-Man. Is he a glory hound? Is he in it for his own ego? That he has that fight that recurs, and this is where I think that note is first struck. It's not just, does Spider-Man make my life miserable, but am I Spider-Man because I crave the spotlight, or because, which is sort of J. Jonah Jameson's argument, is he's a glory hound. Yeah. And this is where it really comes to fruition. He thinks, yeah, maybe I am. I should stop.
Yeah, it also kind of humanizes his decision a little bit more to stop being Spider-Man, even if he only stops being Spider-Man for like 6 pages. But you know, it's not like, boy, life would be easier if I wasn't Spider-Man. It's like, is Spider-Man literally destroying my mind? So it's like, yeah, okay, that's a better case. So, well, Miles, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been so much fun.
Absolutely. Thank you guys both so much for having me. I really enjoyed getting to talk to both of you to talk about these comics. It's been a blast, and I appreciate the offer.
Absolutely. Awesome. What can we plug for you before you take off?
Well, I have 2 podcasts, one of which was a limited series and one of which is ongoing. The latter is, of course, Jay and Miles Explain the X-Men, which if people want to hear way too much detail about decades of X-Men, boy, have we got the show for them. That's at explainthexmen.com or on any podcasting software. I also, a few years back, did a show called Thor, the Lightning and the Storm with Elizabeth Alley, and that covered Walter Simonson's seminal 80s Thor run in a similar fashion. So if people want to hear about that, they can check that out. So, yeah, if you're interested, the internet has episodes waiting for you.
I am, and I will go find that. I didn't know about the Thor podcast, so I will find it.
I didn't either, and I'm a huge Walt Simonson fan, so yeah. I'm going to check that out.
It was a lot of fun.
Well, you know, for us, as far as we're concerned, we are still collecting those Apple Podcast reviews. If you would be so kind as to leave us a 5-star review, send us a screenshot of it. Email that to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com with a mailing address. We will put some goodies in the mail for you. Don't get too excited, but they're pretty. There's some pretty good stuff in there. And then be sure to follow us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth. Marvelbythemonth.com has links to all of our social channels, as well as our shop where you can buy the Stay Inside and Read Comics Mjolnir t-shirt that Rob designed. And I think that's pretty much it for this week. So until next week, my name is Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay inside and read comics.